Hello, and welcome back to The Civic Flame. As always, I'm Professor Amber Bayo, and I'm here to give you some context to the United States Constitution. Last time, we talked about the preamble, and that was probably a surprisingly longer conversation than you were expecting about a single paragraph. Well, today, we're going to discuss Article 1, Section 1, and it's just a sentence. It's important to know that all of Article 1 deals with the United States Congress. It's the legislative branch, and it gets to go first because it was meant to be the most important branch. A bulk of the domestic powers are outlined here to the legislative branch, which includes the Senate and the House of Representatives. Some people refer to them both as Congress, and some people refer to the House of Representatives as the House or as Congress, and the Senate as the Senate. But they're both covered in Article 1. Today, we'll be looking at two key elements. Section 1, which establishes the legislature, and the so-called non-delegation doctrine. We'll get into the House of Representatives next week. Article 1 is the longest article, so this will take a little while. You might want to grab some popcorn. Get your thinking cap on, and let's do this. Article 1, Section 1 says, "All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives." That is all Article 1, Section 1 says. Quick and easy, right? Haha, nope. This sentence has been fought over significantly in the last 100 years. So what does Article 1, Section 1 do? Well, it vests or gives responsibility for all federal legislative powers to a representative bicameral Congress. Legislative powers is the powers to make all the laws. So Congress is the major law-making institution that forms, or is intended to form, the foundation of the federal government's domestic policy-making powers. That means all the stuff inside the country. The way these powers can be executed will be talked about a lot in Section 8, but we'll get to that later. Article 1, Section 1 simply establishes a fundamental feature of the Congress that is different from our first Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, bicameralism, the two houses. This actually comes as a reaction to the failures of the Articles of Confederation, which you'll notice a lot of our Constitution does. It's kind of the second draft. And the Articles of Confederation only had one branch of legislature. But because words matter, these words have been more pulled apart than a stuffed bear near my parents' black lab, which resulted in the other major questions about Article 1, Section 1, the idea of non-delegation. Non-delegation basically means you can't delegate your responsibility. You can't tell somebody else to do it. The phrase, "all legislative powers shall be vested in a Congress," means these powers are for Congress and has been taken to mean that Congress cannot give or delegate them away, nor can any other branch take them. Understand that there are times when Congress may want to hand over its power, and there is ample evidence that since the 1940s, Congress has done a lot of that. This can be for partisan reasons. They share the same party as the president, and it's easier to get one president to do something than 535 members of Congress. Or it could be for a lack of responsibility. They know something is good, but they don't want to take responsibility if it fails. Or it could be for longevity. If you can get power into executive branch offices like the Department of the Interior or the Department of Agriculture, they have more staying power than a simple policy passed by Congress that can be overturned by the next Congress in 2 years. So this can result in delegating some of Congress's powers. A key example of this is when the presidents talk about sending their budget to Congress. Presidents do this all the time. But the reality is, Congress has the power of the purse. It's always Congress's budget. But because the president has the microphone and can talk to the American people whenever they want, it's easier, if you're on the same side, to get the president to talk about his budget. Or if you're on opposite sides, to complain about the president's budget. Either way, the president gets the spotlight and often gets the credit for the budget when it should go to Congress. This gets us into public perception. Most people think the presidency is the more powerful branch, in part because Congress has continued over the past almost 100 years to give more power to the president. Two important cases here. One is Hampton v. U.S. in 1928, where the Supreme Court said, yes, Congress can delegate some tasks to executive agencies, but there are a lot of contingencies here, and they have to be really specific. So this could mean that Congress has power over interstate commerce, any business that goes between two or more states. But the Commerce Department could set and deal with specific rules about road travel or things like that. This often happens if Congress knows there will be evolving policies or experts who need to weigh in. So until recently, executive agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency would have jurisdiction over certain policies because the policies were meant to move with the science. And that's where the scientists work. So Congress gave specific powers with specific rules to those agencies. A bigger case, which is hilariously known as the sick chicken case, Schechter Poultry Corps v. United States in 1935, the Supreme Court held that Congress is not permitted to abdicate or transfer to others the essential legislative functions with which it is thus vested. That's their quote. So this case had to do with food safety and basically meant that while regulating the food industry was important, Congress cannot just hand over its power to the president or executive agencies. Congress has the power. Congress is meant to use it. This is an interesting case because there is a compelling interest in food safety, and there are executive agencies that deal with it, like the FDA, but that Congress still has to take the lead in making the rule and how they are applied. There's a lot of other stuff going on with the sick chicken case, and I highly recommend that you take a look into that because it's both fun and hilarious. These cases are from the same time period because executive, that is presidential, power has been on the rise since 1911. We blame Woodrow Wilson a lot for this. But the 30s and 40s were where it really kicked off in the modern era. And so you see these cases coming from 1928 and 1935. That's because there is still this idea that you absolutely should fight when the president is taking powers from Congress or when any branch is. By the 30s and 40s, things got a little more complicated. Because remember, in the 30s and 40s, not only do you have World War II, which is a massive mobilizing effort across the whole country and, of course, of the whole world, but you also have the Great Depression in the United States. And along with the Great Depression, we get Franklin Roosevelt's The New Deal. But it required so much more federal power and federal reach than had been prominent in the United States, and a lot more presidential leadership and therefore presidential power. So part of Franklin Roosevelt, FDR, his plan to get the United States back on what he saw was a good economic track was by wielding the power of the federal government to stop organizations that were taking advantage of Americans. This included a lot of banks, mortgage companies, things like that, big corporations, and to put Americans back to work, to create a social safety net. This is actually where the Social Security Act first came from, and you get widows and orphans benefits, Social Security, unemployment, and so forth. FDR today would have been considered a social democrat. Basically think Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders kind of platform. And he was so popular that he was elected four times, which is how we got the 22nd Amendment, which says we can only have two terms for the president. But for the first part of his term, he had to fight the Supreme Court, which said he was taking on too much power, both in terms of the scope of his economic plans, the public work projects, the Social Security Act, various banking reforms, and because Congress should be doing some of the work. Once FDR was able to get a majority of budgets on the court, his legislation basically sailed through Congress without a ton of fuss. But there were definitely those times when the courts tried to stem the flow of congressional power to the presidency. Ultimately, the presidency is more powerful today than it has ever been, and consequently, more out of line with the Constitution than it's ever been. And we can blame all presidents for this. One thing it's important to understand with the New Deal is that the New Deal did a lot of good, but there's a lot of controversy around whether it was a benefit or a drawback. And in large measure, this depends on where you're standing, because it was both a benefit and a drawback. In many areas, it helped a lot of national institutions, a lot of urban areas, a lot of the banking systems stabilize. But because of the way the public works worked, because there was a lot of land taken, particularly from rural areas, particularly from the South, and the benefits of any of those projects did not come until decades later, there are a lot of places where the New Deal is looked at negatively. And I think this is one of those important times where we can come together as a country and say, you're not just anti-everything if you oppose the New Deal, right? You're not just pro-everything bad if you support it. You're not anti-everything good if you don't like it. Because there's a lot of fuss still over whether the New Deal was good or was bad for the country. And coming from having grown up in a rural area in Texas, but also being married now to a person who comes from a family of farmers in Massachusetts, I understand very deeply how difficult it is for farm communities when public works projects like this happen, because you do have a lot of a burden on communities like this, especially if you're going to flood somebody's valley in order to create a dam for electricity, but that electricity then goes to the city, right? And not back to your community. When you're going to take somebody off their farm, whether you pay them, whether it's eminent domain or whatever, you take them from a place where maybe they were a dirt farmer making enough to scrape by, but if their brother got kicked off of their family home, they could come stay with you. You still had a house. You still had a place where you felt rooted, to saying, now you can go live in this city. Now you can go live in this work camp. And it was really, really traumatic for a lot of people to have that New Deal program. And I think you didn't see a lot of that in cities that got the benefit of these programs. You didn't see the drawbacks of this, particularly across the country, and the ways in which, even at the time, it created a lot of divisiveness, not necessarily for partisan reasons, but across class lines and across regional lines. Now, today, those things tend to be weaponized in different styles of partisan discourse, right? Left, right, Republican, Democrat. But it's definitely one of those moments where if you hear somebody talking about this very simply in terms of left, right, good, bad, you kind of want to step in and be that obnoxious person who's like, well, it's a little more complicated, because it really is. And I think it highlights we do at times need very serious intervention. We do at times need very serious presidential intervention, but we want to be very careful that the burdens and benefits of those interventions are shared roughly equally as much as possible. Someone is always going to get squeezed in public policy. What we want to try to make sure of is it's not the same people getting squeezed every time. And we want to ask, okay, why are these people getting squeezed and not these people? But the other issue is we want to say, how do we give the president the power when we need them to have it and make sure we take it back when they don't? Because at its core, power loves power. People in a position of power want more power to make their jobs easier. And you don't give power to a person. You give power to an office. So whether you like FDR or you like Harry Truman or you like Dwight Eisenhower or you like whoever, you're not giving power to that person because you like them. You're not giving power to that party because you like them. You're giving power to that office. And sooner or later, and judging by opinion polls of the American public, typically we're never happy with our government, so it's probably going to be sooner, somebody's going to be in some kind of office that you don't like, and you don't want them to have that power. The Constitution is supposed to be what helps us show how do we bind these people up a little bit and make it harder for them to do what we don't want. And that is something we are always going to have to navigate. The non-delegation doctrine says, well, we do that to start by binding the president, by saying Congress not only can't give away these powers, but it has to do its job. And we can blame presidents all we want for this, but it is a perfectly normal reaction to have, right? I blame Congress actually for not standing up for themselves, but I also blame voters for not kicking out Congress. And I also blame the establishment of the DNC and the RNC. Lots of our political party problems come from money and organizations. And the DNC and the RNC are organizations with a lot of money and a lot of networking and a lot of power that help drive up a lot of our partisan political problems and a lot of our problems that are political that can't easily be stuffed into the kind of Democrat or Republican divide. But partisan politics will be a story for another time, and you'll probably want to bring chocolate because that one's depressing. Until next time, keep reading your Constitution. And if you have any questions, hit me up on social media. We are at Designated Optimist on Instagram and Amber Vail on LinkedIn. I'm too old for TikTok and too annoyed for Facebook, but I'll think about doing social media outreach there someday. I'll keep thinking about developing the YouTube page for you and maybe getting an email address. In the meantime, keep the civic flame burning bright and take care. The Civic Flame is a Dr. Fun Sponge Media production with creator Amber Vail and sound producer Matthew Munyon. Thanks for listening.